daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to World Today. I'm Ding He in Beijing. Coming up, China sets economic growth target of around 5% for 2024, vowing to transform its economy. Sticky services inflation emboldens the European Central Bank to resist the calls for interest rate cuts. And China is urging the United States to stop, quote-unquote, overstretching national security claims after Biden ordered investigation of Chinese-made smart cars. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on our previous episodes, download our podcast by searching World Today. China has set an economic growth target of around 5% for 2024. Chinese Premier Li Qiang announced the figure on Tuesday as part of his government work report at the opening of the annual gathering of the National People's Congress. Premier Li Qiang said China must push ahead with transforming the growth model, making structural adjustments, improving quality, and enhancing performance, noting that stability is of overall importance. The Chinese Premier also announced the targets for budget deficit, inflation, urban unemployment, among others. So joining us now on the line are Joseph Mahoney, Professor of Political Science and International Relations with East China Normal University. And also we have joining us on the line Professor Liu Baochen, Director of the Center for International Business Ethics with the University of International Business and Economics. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so Professor Liu, to start with you, the growth targets for this year is similar to last year's targets. Some people say it will be a more challenging path to repeating a 5% or so growth over the course of 2024. Some people say this target is ambitious a little bit, but somehow achievable. What is your take?
I very much concur with the idea that it is a challenging task, but it is achievable in that Chinese economy has been rather resilient over the years. And last year's performance, due to the long tail interruption of the COVID, we were able to achieve 5.2%, which was also very phenomenal. And this year, I think now the economy is getting more and more rehabilitated. And on top of that, the government is going to issue a lot of measures to unleash more liquidity into the market, and more of the infrastructures will be constructed, which can really bring about a substantial contribution to the economic growth figure. And then I think after this two session, more of the confidence will be injected into the private sector, which is there to bring about a better unemployment rate and also maintain a reasonable inflation rate, while we are still very much determined to go for high-quality growth by supporting innovation and also environmentally friendly business operations.
Okay. So in the meantime, we understand the government has set the fiscal budget deficit at about 3% of GDP for 2024, which is lower than the revised deficit of 3.8% in 2023, but really the same as the targets that was initially announced last year. Professor Mahoney, what is your reading about this expected or this announced plan regarding the fiscal government budget deficit over the course of this year?
Well, let me just second, firstly, what my colleague, Professor Liu, was saying. I think that the growth rate that has been offered is sober. I think that it's been a general consensus among economists that this is an achievable growth rate, as long as other major issues remain largely consistent and relatively well managed within China, and as long as we don't see major new headwinds or disruptions internationally. One of the things that the government has signaled again and again is that it wants to have a moderate type of government intervention. It wants to preserve market functions and limit interventions that accrue too much debt, which, you know, these types of actions can too often be exploited by savvy players for short-term windfalls at the public's expense. But of course, you know, if the government is able to achieve a 5.2% growth as it did last year, unexpectedly, then I'm sure then that Beijing will be quite satisfied. Now, with regard to the fiscal budget deficit, I think it's on the one hand, it's clear that they are trying to hem in costs. We see this across the board. I think for those of us who live in Chinese society, there's a lot of cost cutting going on, for example, at the university and other areas, certainly that I can observe firsthand. But at the same time, instead of using fiscal policy to drive growth in terms of the budget, there are other ways to get money into the economy. And I think that's what they're trying to do to offset the deficit that we've seen relative to last year.
So looking into more details, this year, local governments will be allowed to issue some 3.9 trillion yuan of special bonds, which will be mainly used for the purpose of infrastructure construction and spending. And that's representing an increase of 100 billion yuan from last year's level. And also, there is a plan over the course of this year to issue 1 trillion yuan of ultra-long special central government bonds, which is really the first such sales since the year 2020. Now, Professor Liu, some people say policymakers within the central government are nowadays trying to strike a balance between stabilizing GDP growth and controlling debt and financial risks. Is that the case in your observation of these bonds issuance issues?
That's basically the case. But however, because the Central Economic Work Conference set forth stability versus progress, so therefore the progress is becoming more on the priority now. And now, given the lackluster performance of the Chinese real estate sector, and also there's a heavy debt for some of the municipalities where their investment is also having a lot more debt. So therefore, this is really to alleviate the immediate issue of some of the buildings that are not really finished, so that the local governments can have more of the liquidity to address their local issues, and together with the real estate development. And the other is that the local governments are also given the task to boost the high quality development through innovation. So therefore, a lot more investment will have a long lead to turn out really into commercial payoffs. So this really requires more of the liquidity. But having said that, it's not only the infrastructure that's important, but also people are expecting that the government really spent more money to deal with the economy housing for those people who cannot really afford on the commercial rate, and also to address the medical care. And so that, because that really impacts the real quality of life for everybody. And now I think the government is also being cautious in that they do really want to make a balance between economic growth and the controlling information. So therefore, they have ultra-long bonds. They borrow not only from our sons, but also they borrow from our grandsons. But as long as they really turn out to be the practical utility and generate the commercial return, it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay. So in terms of employment issues, this year's goal is to create more than 12 million urban jobs, targeting an urban unemployment rate of somewhere around 5.5%. Last year, of your information, more than 12.4 million jobs were created across China's urban regions and the urban jobless rate was, the surveyed urban jobless rate was 5.1% in December. So, Professor Mahoney, what do you think could be the challenges for this year's employment issue? I mean, for example, you are teaching at an elite university over there in Shanghai, so I would presume that your students would not encounter too many challenges in terms of hunting for jobs after they graduated from college. But I guess that's not necessarily the case for other universities.
Well, it's difficult to say, but I can say with regard to my own students, the majority of whom are women and can sometimes face other challenges when it comes to finding a job. Now, the key point is that there were advantages and disadvantages last year when it came to reaching the 12.4 million new jobs and possibly some unsustainable cost if China tries to repeat the policies pursued last year, which by some estimates included inefficient hiring and retention at state-owned enterprises, some of which were already producing at overcapacity. Now, last year, China faced the challenge of pushing the economy out of its pandemic doldrums, and some pandemic-related controls lingered well past mid-year. But it also had pent-up demand and people who could quickly re-engage in economic activities, especially service industries, which could readily absorb a large number of workers. In short, last year could experience a significant bounce that could help China reach that goal. But we don't necessarily have the same conditions this year. Furthermore, concerns like youth unemployment won't disappear overnight, but officials might be tempted to use underemployment or temporary employment schemes make the numbers look better or even further swelling the ranks of state-owned enterprises. However, with the rubric of new productive forces, we expect state-owned enterprises especially, which have seen productivity declines in recent years, to use more efficient tools like AI, which unfortunately in other countries has increased unemployment. So this is going to be a real challenge, I think. I don't think it's necessarily outside of the range of China's ability to achieve. And so far there are some promising signs from Chinese New Year spending. And certainly I think the policy proposals that have been announced thus far at the new sessions will further embolden confidence, which may also help the employment situation down the line.
Okay. So, Professor Liu, anything to add briefly regarding the employment issue?
Well, I think aside from the economy that is really still managing its stability without much of the higher growth rate, it is also the mismatch between education versus the job requirements. So therefore, that really calls for a whole line of innovation on the educational sector so that the skill sets trained at schools can really meet the immediate demand. So this is really a structural imbalance that is more at stake rather than the entire job market. The other issue, of course, because private sector provides more than 90% of the job opportunities, so more confidence can really be shored up within the private sector instead of asking the state-owned enterprises to increase their overcapacity by having more of the students over there. So that's not really a viable solution. So the whole gist is that how those jobs can be more effective in serving the society instead of simply creating a job opportunity that pays people.
Your point's well taken. Then regarding the issue of inflation, Professor Liu, this year's target is 3%. Actually, some media outlets outside China say China is suffering from a persistent deflation. Would you agree in this point? Why or why not?
Well, I disagree because people see it with different criteria of measurement in terms of the inflation rate. And It is because Chinese calculation of inflation is different to the West for a large reason, because it doesn't really include the housing spending and also the rent. And much is really dependent on those daily utilities, you know, from garments to electronics, et cetera. So structurally, you know, the daily spending is really something that is very promising as, from the consumer side, because some of them are really lowering their price due to the overcapacity of production. And on the other, for the medical bills, you know, for buying big gadgets and also for education, and not to mention housing, it is still on the rise. So therefore, you know, the government is looking at how ordinary people are going to be impacted. So after all, I think 3% of inflation rate versus 5% of the growth rate is rather reasonable. So hopefully that can be properly managed.
Okay. So, Professor Mahoney, what is your take? I mean, if we take a look at China's growth trajectory in 2023, consumption was arguably one of the key drivers back then. So with that in mind, how would you look at this concern on the part of some people that, oh, domestic demand is weak in China, which need more stimulus through, say, physical power?
Well, you know, consumption last year was supported by a number of post-pandemic spending schemes. A lot of local governments offered coupons and other supports. And this certainly intersected, again, with pent-up demand as people were coming out of lockdowns and other forms of controls and had more economic opportunities and before them, and also felt more confidence about being able to earn a living. But we know historically that Chinese officials have been concerned that Chinese consumers have underconsumed, and that if China wants to really emerge as a middle-income country, then people will have to spend more to not only support the domestic economy, but also to enjoy the benefits, the economic benefits and the goods of such an economy, and do so at the expense of a relatively high savings rate. There have been efforts in the past to stimulate consumption, and these have generally not been very successful. So, you know, one of the big questions is what would work and what would be sustainable? It's clear that policymakers are not interested in, you know, massive giveaway schemes. They know that that won't necessarily change behaviors long term, that it could merely increase debt and even, you know, create piles of unwanted goods around the country. So the bottom line is it remains sort of a pickle. A lot of people think that consumption needs to increase, but no one is really sure how to do it. From my perspective, and I don't know if Professor Liu would agree with me, but I think the key is long term, we have to see greater confidence in the long term growth of the Chinese economy. And that will be difficult for a lot of people to have at this point in time, because we're precisely in this moment of transitioning still roughly from a high growth to a moderate growth period and coming out of these other significant challenges. So people have been addicted to this high growth perspective for a long time. And now they're facing, you know, the prospects of 5.2% or 5% growth. And they really feel kind of pessimistic about things. You know, countries like the United States or European countries would be very, very happy to have 5% growth. But nevertheless, in China, this is something that is certainly decreasing optimism. And so finding ways to address that and bringing optimism back into the equation and helping Chinese people have the right perspective, but also the right type of consumption, is something the government's going to have to continue to work through.
So on another front, Professor Liu, there seems to be a greater emphasis or focus on self-reliance in terms of science and technology, as the government decides to boost its annual budget for science and technology by 10%, which, according to some observers of the Chinese economy, represents the biggest increase since the year 2019. What do you think has really prompted this emphasis?
Well, that's a phenomenal increase. To me, it's really quite a surprise because, 10% is really a big number. And the reason, of course, China perceives that we are facing stranglehold from the developed economies, particularly from that of the United States in the technological cooperation. And also China has come to the point that simply by buying technology or emulating the technology, it won't really work anymore. And so therefore, the government is gathering more of the strength to have some of the breakthroughs in order to stay on the frontier of technological innovation. But on the other hand, we should also not really to lose sight over the importance of global cooperation, because technological innovation requires the entire ecosystem and also support from the every phases of the supply chain. So no country nowadays can really have breakthrough technologies totally on a on the premise of autarky. So, it is much of the efforts to address the international relations so that we can really ease some of the tensions in international collaboration. And on the other, the technology does not really mean, something that takes place in the lab. So the actual commercial value out of it is something that's a ultimate measure of the value for innovation. China has created number one in terms of the amount of patents and other IPs. Mm-hmm. But the commercial ability is not really comparable with some of the developed economies. So that's something that the government, business, and even consumers can really join together to really to find a more conducive solution over this issue.
A greater transformation or a greater channel of opening between a research lab and the market forces, that's for sure. So for sure, I guess Premier Li Qiang on Tuesday struck an overall positive tone about the Chinese economy. But in the meantime, he has also acknowledged that the foundations for the continuous recovery is still not very solid. So, Professor Mahoney, the final question before we let you go. In recent years, we understand there has been a greater emphasis on security, and that is something that foreign investors here in China are watching. And in his work report, Premier Li called for making sure that high-quality development and a greater security would reinforce each other. What is your understanding in this regard? 1 minute.
Well, certainly there's been a concern internationally that increasing securitization has curtailed growth, certainly discouraged FDI, and some people will be concerned that his comments suggest that this securitization won't be letting up anytime soon. Alternatively, he might be interpreted as meaning that Chinese tech development, which FDI might find attractive, will benefit from increasing securitization, which is what's happening in the U.S. to some extent. You might also have in mind Chinese initiatives like the Global Initiative on Data Security, which could promote a system of shared security worldwide that would likewise be a boon for data security and tech development in China and worldwide.
Thank you very much for joining us. We have been speaking with Joseph Mahoney, Professor of Political Science and International Relations with East China Normal University, as well as Professor Liu Baochen, Director of the Center for International Business Ethics with the University of International Business and Economics. You're listening to World Today. We'll be back after a short break. You're listening to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. A world-renowned economist says China still has significant growth potential despite certain structural challenges. Former World Bank chief economist Justin Yifu Ling made this very remark at the annual gathering of the country's political advisors in Beijing. Defining China's economic status as a catching-up economy, Justin Yifu Ling says the vast resources, commitment to reform, and determination to sustain dynamic growth are some of the very key factors that will enable China to overcome these challenges and realize its growth potential. And during an interview with my colleague Xu Yawen, Dr. Ling also notes he is very confident that China will continue to remain a key driver for world economy growth. Let's take a listen.
Professor Ling, China has achieved remarkable growth since reform and opening up. And also last year, its GDP growth reached 5.2% higher than expectations, contributing to about 30% of the global GDP. But we still hear some voices hyping up China collapse theory. What's your take on this? And also, what's your perspective on China's economy?
Well, the China collapse theory has been popular in the world. Whenever Chinese economy grows at a rate lower than the expectation, then people will start to say Chinese economy cannot be sustainable. Chinese economy will collapse. But in the past, it has collapsed. Those kind of theory has been refuted so many times. So I'm sure that theory will not realize in the future as well. Certainly, Chinese economy is a transition economy. We have some structural problem. We have to continue to do the reform. But China is catching up economy. We still have huge potential for growth. And the potential is there. And the resources is also there. Determination to maintain dynamic economic growth is also there. So I'm sure Chinese economy will be able to overcome all kind of challenges and to realize its growth potential and continue to maintain relatively high growth and make a contribution to the global economic expansion at around 30%. It has been the case, and I'm sure it will also be the case in the future.
Recently, you also said that China still has an 8% growth potential by 2035, achieving 5-6% growth annually, even amidst competition with the United States and also addressing global warming issues. What led you to this assessment? Could you elaborate more on it?
Well, the growth 8% potential is from the technological side. And as I said, China is a catching up country. We still have the latecomer advantages. And you can look at other countries at a similar level of development. They could realize 8% or more growth. That means there's a potential there from the latecomers' advantages. And also in the new economy, the digital economy, the artificial intelligence, those new economy, China has competitive advantages. So if you put these two technological perspective, I think China should have 8% growth potential. But certainly, if you want to realize the potential, you also need to take into the consideration of other dimensions, and like a global, the geopolitical issue, and also the climate change, and also to take care of the domestic regional disparity and so on. But overall, I think China should be able to maintain 5% or more growth. And that is what we see in the past. Just like in 2023 last year, although globally people expect China would grow less than 5%, but China still grow at 5.2%. And I think that will continue to be the case in the coming years.
Well, we do hear some voices internationally use Japan as an example. Yeah. And suggesting that factors such as China's growing aging population mean the country will gradually lose economic vitality and therefore cannot catch up the economic development of the United States. So what's your take on this kind of opinion?
Well, the Japanese encountered the issue of aging, but there are so many countries also encounter the issue of aging. But other countries, you know, their growth rate did not drop. Their growth rate even accelerated. So for Japan, its slow growth after, you know, Plaza Akuo in 1985, and especially in 1990s, I think it was not because of aging. It was because they did not have continuous technological innovation and industrial upgrading due to, on the one hand, they surrendered themselves to the pressure from the U.S. to give up their advanced sectors, that is, semiconductor sectors. And secondly, they gave up the practice of industrial policy to support the new industry, new technologies. And as a result, Japan lost its dynamism in technological innovation, industrial grading. And as a result, that productivity cannot be increased. And that was the main reason for the sluggish growth in Japan. And so it was not because of aging. And I think that China will now follow similar mistakes. And China will continue to support our technological innovation, industrial grading. We will continue to maintain our economic dynamic growth.
You mentioned a couple of times about the new economic fields, such as new energy, big data, and artificial intelligence. Do you still believe that China has the most opportunities globally? And also in those sectors I just mentioned, do you think China has the potential to surpass and even lead the world in these areas?
Well, I think that certainly we already see that. For example, electronic vehicles. Now China is a global leader. And like in the 5Gs, China is global leaders. So I think in those new economy, China has competitive advantages. We can be, you know, the global leader in quite a number of sectors. Certainly, now in the new economy, we need to, you know, cooperate with other countries. That would be a win-win for every country. But in case, you know, like U.S. wanted to decouple from China, and under that kind of situation, certainly we will develop those technology by ourselves. But I think that it would be better if we have an open system and we can rely on area we have competitive advantages and to exchange with other countries for area they have competitive advantages. And that would be a better scenario. But anyway, China is a large economy, and I think that in areas U.S. use its policy, try to decouple from China, it's a choice of U.S. But for Chinese point of view, we will try to be as open as possible.
Professor Lin, what does the stable and sustainable development of China's economy mean for the global economy and for the world?
I think that for any country, growth is the most important thing, because growth can create job, growth can increase income. And that would be the primary foundation for social political stability in any country also. And China maintains the growth as I predicted. China will be able to make contribution around 30% to the global economic growth. And it would be a good news for China, but it would be a good news for almost every country in the world.
That was world-renowned economist, Dr. and Professor Justin Yifu Lin talking to my colleague Xu Yawen. You are listening to World Today. We'll be back. Inflation in the Eurozone eased less than expected in February as consumers and investors wait for interest rate decision by the European Central Bank later this week. In February, inflation over there in the Eurozone rose by 2.6%, still short of the ECB's 2% target. The figure in February was down from a reading of 2.8% rise back in January, with prices for goods like food, alcohol, and tobacco remaining high stubbornly. Core inflation, which excludes energy and food prices, was up by 3.1% in the month of February. So for more, as well as on the European economy, my colleague Zhao Yang earlier had a talk with Yan Liang, professor of economics with William Matt University.
So, Yan, the inflation across most economies in Europe continued to fall in February, and consumer prices in the Eurozone was up 2.6% in the month. This is down from 2.8% in January. So is it good news or bad news for the Eurozone economy, or something in the middle?
Yeah, so I think this is a good news in the sense that, you know, this would then allow the ECB to decide on rate cuts sooner than later. Right now, a lot of the forecasters believe that the ECB is going to hold that 4% of interest rate stable until later in the year, around October. So I think, you know, with the inflation rate goes down more quickly, that would probably help ECB to cut rates earlier. And I think that would help to steady the economic ship. Because when you look at the EU economy or the Eurozone economy, they're really growing at a very slow pace. The first estimate right now is GDP increased by about 0.5% in the euro area and also the EU. So that's barely positive growth. So I think, you know, with inflation that is decelerating, or what we economists call disinflation, hopefully the ECB will start cut rates early, and that will help the economy to grow better. And for the consumers and for, you know, their jobs, their wage growth, those would be, you know, improved if the rate cuts start early.
Mm. And we know that on the energy front, which is a big driver of inflation, are deflating a little bit more. And we still remember that the energy prices have been very volatile in Europe over the past 18 months, given the conflict of Ukraine. But energy costs have really started to come down this year. So how do you explain it? Will this trend continue throughout the whole year?
Right. So I think, you know, with the sort of energy shock with the Russia-Ukraine conflict, that's why, you know, a lot of European countries are seeing the energy costs jumping and seeing the inflation rate was much elevated, you know, all through 2022. And then with 2023, I think, you know, countries start to shift to new energy sources. They start to find ways to economize their energy uses. They have, you know, different policies, for example, to have the VAT tax on, you know, energy. So a lot of these demand cuts, unfortunately, could lead to deindustrialization in some sectors. But still, this helped to overcome this energy cost hikes, and therefore it helped to stabilize inflation. And globally, what we are seeing is that, you know, the United States has been increasing oil and energy production and exports. OPEC countries, even though they were cutting some of their oil exports and production, still, you know, with the softened demand in the world, that's why we start to see the price has gone down. When you look at, for example, the Brent crude oil index, right now is trading at about $83 a barrel, which is way lower than, you know, what it was at about 100 and above. And so I think the energy costs that has been declining over time in the past 2 years were really very helpful. I mean, in 2023, was very helpful for this disinflation in the European countries.
Mm. And yeah, so if the energy costs have started to really come down this year, so what is fueling the rise of the CPI in Europe now?
Right. So I think some of the arguments are, you know, it's because of the relatively tighter labor market. Right. So when you look at countries like Germany, their unemployment rate now was at 5.7%, which is quite low. France, 7.2%. So these largest European economies start to see their employment, the job markets improving, and therefore they worried about, you know, sort of the wage-led inflation. But I think that's probably a concern that is a little bit overblown. When you look at the negotiated pay increase, for example, it has gone up this last year in 2023 by, I think, 4.5%. And that is already lower than what it used to be at 4.7% earlier in 2023. And as also, let's not forget, even though, you know, people look at this number and say, wow, 4.5% increase in the pay is much higher than, you know, inflation, and therefore that's going to drive inflation up. But at the same time, I think what we need to understand is that between 2022 and 2023, the real wage, which is, you know, wage adjusted for inflation, was actually dropped by roughly 5%. So I think workers are now just starting to catch up, right, that they're compensating a little bit for the loss of the real wage back in 2022. So I think, you know, this idea of wage-led inflation is probably overblown. Mm-hmm. And one of the other factors that might be important here is to also look at the profit margin at the corporate level. And I think there's some evidence that shows some of the big companies, they charge higher prices more than what the rising cost would warrant. And so I think, you know, the inflation picture is too complicated. But it is towards better direction in terms of, you know, because of the energy cost issue.
Mm. And let's talk about the country by country. Europe's two largest economies, Germany and France, they both reported a decline in the consumer prices increase. And Germany's annual CPI fell to, you know, 2.7% in February, while France was at 3.1%. And this is lowest level in 2.5 years. So what does that mean for their economies?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think, you know, again, in the past 2 years, these countries have spent so much energy and so much efforts trying to bring down the inflation. But at the same time, I think their economy really struggled. When you look at Germany's GDP, it contracted by 0.3% in 2023. France grew at 0.8%, which, you know, is a positive growth, but it's very small, right, increase. So I think what these countries need to do now is to really start focusing on, you know, how to boost their economy, their economic performance, while, of course, keeping that inflation in check. Both countries were looking at fiscal austerity in the coming year. Germany has a, you know, budget shortfall of, you know, 60 billion euros, again, because by constitution, they were only allowed to run certain deficits or use certain emergency funding, you know, when the economy is in emergency. So now the idea is that the pandemic has been the thing of the past. They are not allowed, right, to use the pandemic related money and to spend in their green transition or climate change related investments. Mm-hmm. So that would leave them in a very, leave this fiscal policy in limbo, and that would really dampen the economy. Mm-hmm. France is pretty much the same thing. They are planning to cut 16 billion euros in terms of fiscal spending. I think that would, again, dampen their economy. So that is not desirable when both countries really need to have more investment in their infrastructure, in their technology, in their people. I think the focus should be more on how to really manage their economic growth.
Mm. And we've seen the stock markets around the world is starting this month, March, on a record high. The U.S. stock gets quite high, and also the German, you know, follow this lead. And talking about how high the markets are at the moment, so what's the reason for that? And is it because the Federal Reserve interest rate cut in June is still being baked in? And do you think that's going to happen? And what's going to happen in Europe in terms of the interest rate cuts?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I do think that market sentiment, the kind of expectations on both, you know, the development of AI and also the Fed cutting the rates, these are really positive expectations that help to drive the stock market. And on also at the same time, I think, you know, companies, they are very cash rich and they're profitable in the past 2 years, start to see the signs of consumers spending, right, that it's still remaining high in the U.S. But I think in Europe, for example, 75% of their loans by households and enterprises are floating rates, which means they're looking at much higher interest payments, they're looking at much higher cost of getting credit. So I think, you know, they're still spending because they had some windfall from the COVID years with the stimulus, but that would run out. And so I think, you know, if the Fed and the ECB do not start cutting rates soon or as expected, that's going to dampen market sentiment. That's going to, you know, reduce the consumer demand. And that is possibly, you know, drag down the economy. But of course, right now, I think the market is pretty euphoria, you know, driven by these expectations about, you know, technologies, especially AI, as well as, you know, the expectation of rate cuts.
Dr. Yan Liang, professor of economics, was William Matt University talking to Zhao Yang. You're listening to World Today. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. China has expressed serious concerns about the Biden administration ordering a probe into the national security risks possibly posed by Chinese-made smart cars. China's Commerce Ministry said on Monday that the U.S. action is a typical practice of protectionism that will disrupt global auto supply chains and hurt American consumers. China's foreign ministry has also urged Washington to stop overstretching the concept of national security. The Biden administration announced its order sometime last week, saying the move was designed to ensure that America maintains its quote-unquote dynamic auto industry. So joining us now on the line is Andy Mok, tech analyst and a senior research fellow with the Center for China and Globalization. Thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure to be with you, Ding Hong.
So this so-called concern on the American side or on the side of the Biden administration is that Chinese vehicles could well collect some sensitive data about American citizens and American infrastructure networks, and those information could be well sent back to China, which will then be accessed by Chinese authorities. Do you think that's a legitimate concern?
Well, you know, Ding Hong, I don't think it's a legitimate concern. First of all, we have to appreciate that cybersecurity is a very real concern. But whether the cars are American, Chinese, European, those threats would still exist. So I think that this is, in a way, a kind of a red herring that is not facing the real issue.
Okay. So part of the Biden administration's motives here, as Biden has suggested personally, is to prevent Chinese-made EVs from flooding the U.S. market. However, you know better than I do, Andy, because this Inflation Reduction Act rolled out by the Biden administration is already, I think, to a very large degree, excluding Chinese brands or Chinese-made electric vehicles or smart cars from the American market, right? So what's the point of launching this probe on the national security ground?
Well, there's a saying that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. And I think here we might be able to paraphrase that, that national claims of national security are the last refuge of the scoundrel, in that I think the very real concern here is not national security as most people would define it, but a very real fear that the U.S. auto industry is just not able to compete. And this is a very challenging problem and a dilemma, I would say, for the United States government, because on the one hand, especially for a Democratic administration, that there are elements of the Democratic coalition that prioritizes mitigating the effects of climate change, and EVs play a crucial part here. At the same time, I think the Biden administration fears the advances in that the Chinese EV industry has made. And, you know, it's very interesting that I think there has been cases of where in Europe that the Chinese can sell an EV at what it costs a European auto manufacturer to produce the car. So, you know, this really is a difficult dilemma, I think, that the Biden administration faces. But I do think that claims of national security are a red herring.
So as I was doing research about our topic today, I somehow learned that in terms of trade in both ways, the United States is actually exporting way more cars to China, I think three times higher than the other way around. And in terms of America importing EVs from China, actually the element in the room here is actually Tesla, which we know manufactures some of its models and autos over there in Shanghai. So if we're talking about a scenario in which Tesla's China-made cars will be targeted by any future U.S. action based on this investigation we are talking about here, do you think the U.S. by doing so will ultimately backfire and hurt U.S. corporate interests?
Oh, I absolutely do, Ding Hong. So, again, these measures hurt American consumers. So for a number of years, the price of automobiles has become prohibitive for many Americans. And we see today, you know, with BYD, for example, offering very inexpensive electric vehicles that are also very high quality as well. And, you know, it's a pity that these are not available to American consumers. So I would not be surprised at all that there is other types of collateral damage from this kind of this type of misguided policies.
So the last question before we let you go briefly, in the EV industry, do you think things are somehow developing in a trajectory that is somewhat similar to what we have already witnessed in some of the other industries like 5G, where national security is really being abused, let's put it this way, to disrupt some of the normal international business operations?
I do, unfortunately, Ding Hong, that this is exactly what I think is happening. And ultimately, though, I think the result will be that the U.S. will be increasingly isolated and increasingly a technological backwater as China advances in 5G, electric vehicles, other technologies of the future, and that this only hurts American consumers and ultimately American businesses as well.
Thank you very much for joining us. As always, that's Andy Mock, a tech analyst and a senior research fellow with the Center for China and Globalization. That's all the time for this edition of World Today. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on our previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Ding Hun in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.